So, good afternoon. We're going to open the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on General Government. Today is February 17th, 2015. We are going to open or continue, well, we're going to open our public hearing on Senate Bill 5502 and continue our discussion on the Department of Administrative Services. Paul, anything we need to be thinking about?
Mr. Chair, there's no responses from questions today, so I'm working with the department for Thursday's presentation on assessments. I think it's coming along pretty well, so you'll see that on Thursday.
Perfect. Thank you. So, Director Jordan. Deputy Director Pack. Ma'am. Come on up. I don't have your name. Tell me your name.
Janet. For the record, Janet Sabar with DAS CFO.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Michael Jordan. I'm the director at the Department of Administrative Services and the chief operating officer for the state. Today, as billed, we're back on schedule, kind of, and we're going to be talking about the Enterprise Asset Management Division at DAS, along with a couple of other special topics, a partnership that we're looking at with Chariots, the mass transit provider here in the Salem area, and then the move that's proposed by the Office of Administrative Hearings from the Employment Department over to DAS. Barry is going to be your cruise director today, and I'm just the pretty face, so I'll attempt to obviously be here for any of your questions. So with that, Barry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Again, for the record, Barry Pack, Deputy Chief Operating Officer at DAS. Enterprise asset management, think things real estate, facilities, property, those sorts of things, cars. So within enterprise asset management, we've got fleet and parking services, surplus property, which disposes of local, federal, and state surplus property. Real estate services, we talked a little bit about last week on our leasing agents and the work they're doing for agency leasing. Planning and construction management handles all the project management for capital projects that DAS does, as well as the interior space design and configuration work for agencies. Facility operations and maintenance, pretty self-explanatory. They maintain and operate all of the buildings that DAS owns and operates. So that's the big picture. Again, as you'll have seen in other DAS divisions, the primary purpose is the central oversight, so that allows agencies to focus on their specific business needs. If they don't have to worry about who changes the light bulbs, their staff can focus on getting their clients served. And then also being able to have all of that knowledge in one area, all that expertise, really can sort of leverage additional resources that agencies, if they were trying to do it on their own, they just simply wouldn't have the depth of experience necessarily. A couple of primary driving factors in this division's budget. We have older buildings. They are aging. We're keeping up with the maintenance, but it still requires continued, in some cases, it will require some increased investment to avoid building up a backlog of deferred maintenance. The market is changing. We talked last week about the significant savings we were able to see when we renegotiated our leases. Well, that was at a period where the real estate market was really low. It's starting to pick back up again, and so those changing market factors affect our business. Volatile costs in fuel are another driving factor. We came back to the emergency board last year for some additional limitation requests because fuel prices had gone up so much, and they, of course, now have gone down and are climbing again, so it's really unpredictable. We're in a global market. For that, we're also seeing the benefits of the sunny February. We've not had the hard winters that we've had in the past, so our buildings aren't spending as much on heating.
So let me ask this question. So how does that work as we come to the end of a biennium? There's ups, there's downs. If there is, if we didn't spend as much as we anticipated, how does that get reconciled?
Mr. Chair, that would be a good question for Mr. Siebert, but we do our best to predict that, and so the limitation that is provided accounts for what we believe to be what our expenditure need is. We generate revenue to try to match that need. If we don't spend all of that money, continues forward as beginning cash balance for the next biennium, which is something that the Legislative Fiscal Office staff looks at routinely.
And I answer. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I believe that the fleet now operates for fuel on a reimbursement basis with agencies. So the agencies actually pay the cost of the fuel. So you pay a per day charge, then you pay the cost of the fuel, so that it's essentially pass through limitation they get from agencies. So obviously if gas prices go down, they won't be paid as much. So they might have some empty limitation in the department, and that would be something that we'd have to take a look at as the budget's developed. You know, of course, we can, you know, you have the option of reducing that limitation and then telling the agency to return later to an emergency board like they just did for additional limitation if the limitation you approve for fuel proves to be inadequate.
Interesting. Thank you. Appreciate it. Let's continue.
And then just one aspect to surplus. We're seeing with the tighter budgets, both federal and state and local agencies are holding on to their assets longer, which means when they do come to surplus for disposition, there's less economic value left in whatever that property is. And there are also private companies that handle surplus property for local governments who are not required. They're able to go through the state surplus, but they're not required to. And so we are, in some cases, in competition with the private sector in that area. We'll go into depth on some of these on Thursday, but this graph just shows you sort of the mixture of funding sources that come to the various programs within enterprise asset management. So for the most part, you'll see it's mostly charges for service, which are those that bottom category, whether it's uniform rent or leasing or fleet services or parking. They're paying only just for the parking space that their employees are using or things like that, versus assessments, where we're charging all state agencies for the benefit of a service that's provided to everybody. Taking a little snapshot about the buildings we own, this shows you the 48 buildings, 2.3 million square feet across the state that DAS owns and operates. We have 27 parking lots and 3 parking structures.
Hold it, what? Excuse me.
Yes.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Representative Comp.
How many parking
structures?
27 parking lots.
Right.
And 3 parking structures across the state.
That's enough?
Mr. Chair, Representative Comp, no.
That's what
we'll
I was wondering.
We'll get there in a little bit.
Okay, because that didn't compute.
And these are just the ones the DAS owns and operates, so this doesn't include private parking lots that are in leased spaces.
Okay.
But thank we will you, take a look Chair. Now.
No problem.
This next picture shows you our lease footprint by size. So the circles, the size of the circles, a little key off to the size, shows the number of square feet that are in each of those buildings. You'll see a big chunk in the Portland-Salem area, but all distributed all throughout the state. And this is about 4.2 million square feet of leased space. A sense of our footprint. We spoke earlier about a facility condition assessment, and we have gone through all of the DAS-owned buildings. What is represented in the data on this slide is 45 of those buildings. We've completed the rest of it, just hasn't been able to update the numbers yet. The story here really is we're doing good. We've got 91% of the buildings are in good condition or fair condition. Only 8% are poor. There's some rounding issues there, but those are the general numbers. And then forecasting out to 2023, if we don't keep up with the maintenance, if we don't continue to spend, and we estimate to be about $84 million over 10 years, if we don't do that kind of maintenance work, the conditions of our buildings would greatly deteriorate. So the good news is we're keeping up on the maintenance, but it comes at a cost, but we need to be able to continue that on a go-forward basis. Wanted to bring to you one small little project that doesn't get much notice, but actually does have a nice little benefit. We've begun upgrading the historic lighting fixtures here on the Capitol Mall. And those have all been replaced now. You'll see the numbers here, the total project cost, but then the savings over the lifetime of over $400,000 moving into LED fixtures in those historic light fixtures. Moving to state surplus, for many years, surplus was operating in the red. We weren't generating enough revenue through the sales of the property to meet the expenses, and they were being covered by other areas in the division. The CUB took a look and worked very closely with the surplus staff to turn some things around to get to what we would call the path to break even. They significantly reduced the square footage of the warehouse where all this property is stored by about 10,000. That was simply by consolidating and then leasing that extra 10,000 square feet of space off to another agency that needed storage capacity. They were able to install some new inventory software, which did a couple of things. It improved the efficiency of getting property in and cataloged in inventory, but it also allowed people in the public and other agencies to view the inventory online, so they weren't having to call up and ask, what do you have? Do you have a table? Do you have this kind of cars? They could go and see it online. All of those business process changes combined allowed the division to reduce their FTE by 3 through attrition. So we've got smaller personal services helping there. And then the CUB, as part of their proposed rates for the next biennium, added an assessment piece to some of the base operating costs, the things that you would have to do regardless of whether or not you were selling property. And then the rest of the funding for surplus comes through commissions off of the sales of property. Fleet. Yes.
Representative Dickinson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've even visited the facility, but now I'm trying to recall. Allowing public and other agency, whether it's state or local, to see what the state is surplusing, or are we also taking things in that are brought in from federal or local agencies?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nathanson, surplus handles local, state, and federal property. So we are the designee of the federal surplus property. So anything that is surplus to Oregon comes through state surplus. Okay. Some local governments choose to use us to dispose of their property, others don't. So it's a mixture there. Who gets to buy that property depends on what the property is. If it's a federal surplus, it can only go to state agencies or local governments. If it's state or local property that's being surplused, the public can buy it.
And since we're brokering this arrangement, by the way, I just love reduce, reuse, recycle, repurpose. I'm glad we're able to make this service available. Is it considered a donation? How is money transferred? Do we send money back to a local government if they've sold something through us? And then do we keep a little bit for administrative overhead? Is that how that works?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Nathanson, there is a flat percentage on – it depends on the type of property. Again, nothing is as easy as a simple answer, but it depends on the type of property, whether it's a titled vehicle or just property. We do take a cut, as you will, to manage the disposition of the property, and then the rest of that goes back to the donating agency. So last biennium, I think – let's see – we return about $7 million to state agencies per biennium through sales for the surplus.
Thank you.
Okay. We used this slide 2 years ago, and I brought it back because I thought it was an effective depiction of why we maintain a fleet. We maintain a fleet so that state employees can focus on the jobs they need to do. And this graphic is a depiction of a child welfare employee from DHS who gets to work, picks up the car, drives to the client's house, picks up a kid, takes the kid to school, maybe takes them back to the apartment afterwards. Then they've got a court hearing. They've got to take the parents or the kid to the court. They're able to take them back to their house or back to some other after-school activity that they're next scheduled in. They go and pick up another client. They're able to go back to that house. They have to go back to court. And then they're back to the office. All of that is facilitated by DAS maintaining a fleet of about 4,000 vehicles, mostly sedans and light trucks.
So who maintains the vehicle policies on personal use, et cetera? Is that by department, or is there a standard DAS procedure?
Go ahead. They're overall.
Mr. Chair, so there's, if I understood your question correctly, we maintain the cars.
Okay.
The policies, the insurance policies for that, those cars. No, that's not what you're asking.
What I'm referring to is the state employee out in rural eastern Oregon that lives 35 miles from the state office, and it's closer after the map to drive home than it is to drive all the way back.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we do have standard policies statewide for when you need to use a state vehicle, when you could use a personal vehicle if it made more sense, and there's a way to go through in the policy and decide. And then there's a control on that. Some manager has to say it's okay to use your vehicle. When you do, there are different reimbursement rates for that. But generally speaking, I will say we want state employees in state vehicles. There are liability issues and insurance issues. The maintenance of the car itself, we want to make sure is maintained at a standard that it's safe on the road to be driving, et cetera. So
there's a rational plan in place.
Absolutely.
That takes into consideration the special circumstances.
That's right. We have statewide policy on the use of vehicles.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Kump.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question comes to my mind when, and I don't go shopping very often at Washington Square, but you're driving up to Washington Square and you pass about three cars that has DAS on it, and, you know, it's mom, three kids, on a Saturday morning, and it's like, and a bell's ringing in my head. It's like, is that our taxpayers' dollars?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Comp, I get a call like this about once a month, maybe more often sometimes. And so we usually, the person who calls has a license plate number to give me, or an email I get with a license plate number. We track down who used the vehicle and for what purpose. Often I will tell you something like that probably isn't a mom. It's probably a woman caseworker with three children
in the
car on to an activity on Saturday morning or school or something or a doctor's appointment. That's often the case.
The reality.
Now, I would be remiss if I didn't say occasionally we run into an employee who's misused a vehicle and we know who they are and we do take the appropriate action. So,
thank you. The clarification of, you know, particularly Saturday after activities for foster children or whatever.
That's often the case.
Yeah. Thank you.
One of the principal issues that we need to look at when we're managing the fleet is the replacement schedule. Cars age as they get older and put more miles on them. And about 10 years ago, at the start of some of the state's big budget problems, the Fleet and Parking Services took about a $10 million reduction in their replacement fund, which dramatically slowed our ability to keep at an optimal replacement stage. We have, over the last couple of biennium, been building that back up to where we are closer to being able to maintain the optimal replacement schedule. If you look at this top graph here, you'll see that in the industry for a fleet like ours, so mostly light trucks and sedans, the recommended industry average age of a fleet should be between about 4.5 and 5 years for each car. Our standard is 8 years or 115,000 miles. That's where we're trying to be at. If you look at that bottom chart, which I had to sit down 3 or 4 times and have explained to me multiple times to be able to explain it to you, the economic theory of vehicle replacement, it's actually fairly simple once I got it in my head. The blue line is the capital asset, the value of the vehicle or the value of the fleet. Mm-hmm. The green line is what it costs to maintain that car. And you want to make sure that the average of your fleet is that sweet spot where those two lines meet, where it's you're not paying more to maintain the car than it's actually worth. And that red line on the top is that those two costs combined.
So do we lease our vehicles or do we purchase our vehicles?
Mr. Chair, we purchase our vehicles.
Okay, so then that does make sense. I mean, at that point in time, based on this chart, where the sweet spot is, we're anticipating we'll be able to sell it for approximately that price In theory?
Yes, in theory, we would be able to sell it.
Plus or minus, I mean, I understand, but that's...
And as vehicles age, they can be put into different service. So, for example, a DCBS building codes inspector might have a truck that they drive from building to building to building to building. They put a lot of miles on that truck in 3 years. They put 90,000 miles on that truck in 3 years. So they're getting really close to that 115,000 mileage point where we'd want to replace the vehicle, but it's only 3 years old. So at that point, we would take that truck away, assign that employee a new car, and take that 90,000-mile truck and give it to a parks employee who only needs to drive around the park. So we can then put it into a low-mileage usage and extend the life of that vehicle out more towards the 8 years, 115,000 mile.
And I don't know if you'll have the answer for this or not. So I saw in Roseburg, I think it was last year, a Chevy Volt that was owned by the state. I have a Volt, but I'm a private person. I was able to get the tax credit and whatnot. I'm assuming the state of Oregon can't use that in any way. Correct me if I'm wrong. Would you answer that first, actually, before I go on?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Hurd, I will double-check with our staff, but I don't think that the state...
We don't pay taxes.
We don't pay taxes, so I don't know how we would get a tax credit.
Follow up?
Yeah, please continue.
Okay. So from a business standpoint, which is what we're talking about, making the best investment for the state's taxpayers' money, it would seem like to me, I know we want high-mileage vehicles, it would seem like to me, as the chart showed up here, the little picture, it had a Prius in it. To me, a Prius is a much better investment of our money than a Volt is for the state's purposes. Any reason why, it may not have anything to do with DAS, but do you know why we had that Volt?
You go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hurd, we have two electric vehicles, electric vehicles.
Yeah.
There are a variety of policy statements, both in statute and in executive order, that direct us to attain a certain level of fuel efficiency within our overall fleet.
Mm-hmm.
And so part of that is higher mileage vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
Part of that then is hybrids, which you are correct, have a better return on investment for the kind of use that we have than a purely electric vehicle does. And also, as we have limited charging stations, it's a little more difficult to use. So it's a very small portion. We have over 4,000 cars and just two electrics.
But you're simply doing that to follow up. Sorry,
yeah, please.
You're simply doing that to meet some mileage.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hurd, both the overall fleet mileage is a target, but we also see where the industry's going,
mm-hmm.
and trying to experiment about can these cars actually be used in the kind of work we do? How difficult is the issue of refueling stations, electric stations? So we put them in service where they can be used,
mm-hmm.
but it's really an experiment and trying to stay ahead of the industry, and we know that the industry is moving in that direction, and so trying to get some sense of how could we use electric vehicles over time.
So that was one of the two?
Yeah, there are only two.
All right. And Mr. Chair, as well, Representative Hurd, Oregon is part of a multi-state agreement to increase zero-emission vehicle usage between the states, and one factor of those agreements is increasing zero-emission vehicles in state fleets.
I have a quick question. I'm way out on a tangent here, then we'll get back. On electric vehicles, you're not going to know the answer, but if you could help me find this. On electric vehicles, are the plug-ins are they uniform? Is a Chevy Volt plug-in the same as a Tesla plug-in?
No.
They're not.
The Tesla, I think, is the only one that's different.
Interesting. That's too bad. Let me share with you why.
I believe there's
converters, they're putting these plug-ins around the state, and it's too bad that they weren't coordinated to enhance this use of vehicles. Let's move forward. Sorry about that. We can talk later.
That's right. All right.
Are you going to get one?
Can't afford it.
You can.
The Tesla or the Charger.
Yeah, I know.
I can afford a little battery car.
No kidding.
Let's continue.
All right. Another aspect of maintaining the fleet is customer demand. And so every biennium, as we put a budget together and a budget request, we ask agencies what their predicted need is going to be for fleet vehicles. And we do our best to work with them to get as accurate of a prediction as we can. And that's what we put in, into our budget request to be able to provide the funding for those additional vehicles. Now, sometimes
programs change, federal laws change, federal programs change, and there's a new demand for service. And we, at times, will be coming back to the emergency board and ask for additional limitation to buy those additional cars. In the budget request that you have before you, in Senate Bill 5002, or is that our number? I think so. includes the purchase of 52 additional vehicles. Those are vehicles that we anticipate having a need to fill at some point in the biennium. That it's sort of the anticipated, unanticipated demand, right? We've built into our overall budget the demand that we know, and then we think there'll be at least 52 more vehicles that will be asked for by agencies mid-biennium, and we'll provide those on a first-come, first-served basis if the budget is approved. And then if there's additional demand beyond that, that's when we'll be coordinating with agencies to time an e-board ask at the appropriate time, working obviously with your staff on that. As we just talked a little bit, we are working on improving the efficiency of our fleet, so both fuel efficient usage, and then we have minimum mileage standards for an agency to have a dedicated car. So there's generally two types of ways that an agency might use fleet. They've got an employee who needs to drive to Pendleton for a meeting. They reserve a car like they would reserve a car at any rental shop. They pick it up, drive it to their meeting, drive it back, drop it off. Then there are agencies that have constant need for vehicles. So the child welfare caseworker that we talked about, or the DCBS building code inspectors, those agencies have vehicles assigned to them. Depending on the type of vehicle, there are various minimum mileage standards that are required to meet to maintain that dedication and to maintain to make sure that we're using our vehicles the most efficient way. Our top 10 agencies get quarterly reports from us on their mileage usage so that they're able to review how they're using their cars. They can reassign them if, you know, they've got someone who's driving mostly within a city limits. You won't want them driving in a hybrid because you need to have the larger, longer miles for that hybrid to be most efficient. So we work with them to manage how they're using their vehicles, and then if they're not meeting those minimum mileage standards over a period of time, then that car gets returned to fleet so we can reassign it to an agency who has a need.
We have a question here. Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if you have a smaller agency or a type of job that doesn't meet that mileage threshold, do you ever consider sharing a car or an intergovernmental agreement with local government? I've asked about this before in the shared motor pools conversations in previous sessions. Do we ever make arrangements to share vehicles? Or we would buy it and they would like rent it, pay us for the use, or vice versa. Maybe we don't want to buy it, but we know that the city of Pendleton or the city of Astoria or a certain community college has some what they call fleet cars that aren't solidly booked, and then we could use them occasionally. It doesn't always have to be us. We can use other people's stuff, I assume.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nathanson, I'm not aware of every nuanced relationship we have with a local government. However, I do know that many local governments use our vehicles on a lease basis. So at Metro, we leased our whole fleet from DAS. So I know that many local governments do that. The nuanced relationship of one particular agency and a local community sharing a vehicle, I'm not aware of that, but we'll look and I'll ask and see if we have those relationships.
Brief follow-up?
Yeah, please.
Thank you. The point I've made in the past is sometimes local governments could use our help too, and we don't always have to be the big guy who provides everything. If it helps them out and it helps us out too, I don't know why we couldn't cooperatively use their vehicles instead of us thinking we always had the only solution because we're the state.
That's a good point.
Thank you.
Moving on to Representative Comp's question earlier about parking. Parking demand continues to be high, particularly in the Capitol Mall area where we've got so many buildings and so many state employees. We have programs to try and encourage carpooling and vanpooling, bike rooms and lockers in some buildings for folks who want to take those alternative methods of commuting. But right now, in this Capitol Mall area, we have an over 900 spot waiting list for parking spots in the Capitol Mall. So those 27 parking lots and three parking structures are not sufficient. So we are looking at ways to try and to meet that demand. And it can't always be through a parking spot. That's why we are looking towards alternative commuting options. And we'll be talking in just a minute about a bus program in the Salem area. So I think with that, Mr. Chair, if with your permission, we have Alan Pollock here, who's the general manager of Chariots, the Salem-Keizer Transit District, and we'd like to invite him to share a few thoughts about a bus pass program. In the past, the state purchased bus passes for employees in the Salem area so that they could take the bus to work. It was a budget reduction that we took a few years ago, and we'd like to propose restoring some of that program. And with that, I'll
thank you,
Mr. Pollock.
Co-Chair Smith, members of the committee, I'm Alan Pollock, general manager for Salem-Keizer Transit. Thank you for the opportunity to talk about the bus pass program. So originally, back in July 2005, Chariots and the state partnered for the employee bus pass program for Capitol Mall employees. That was terminated after the 2009 legislative session as a result of budget balancing decisions. For background, Salem-Keizer Transit provides the fixed route service within the Salem-Keizer urban growth boundary. We provide over 600 hours of service a day, with nearly every route coming into the downtown Salem area, either serving the Capitol Mall directly or indirectly from our downtown transit station, which is about a 4 or 5 minute walk. Just to give you some perspective, the routes that do serve the Capitol Mall area, we average about 4,000 ons and offs a day. Certainly not all state employees, but shows the high transit usage in the downtown area. If this bus pass program were to be implemented, the state employees who live within the urban growth boundary would have direct access to all the transit service via our existing network of routes. And for those who may live outside the urban growth boundary, we offer a series of park and ride lots that they would be able to drive to, park at, no charge, and take the bus the rest of the trip into the downtown area. We believe the benefits of this program are many, including the ability to help reduce that parking demand that you just heard about, also reduce downtown congestion, especially during peak periods of travel. By using environmentally friendly buses, it helps to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Just half of our buses operate on compressed natural gas. The other half, we use biodiesel. And for those that even choose to drive to and from their home to work, the bus pass program still allows the opportunity for them to use the bus during the day, whether it be to go into meetings or during lunch hour to go downtown to eat or shop. So for all those reasons, we believe reinstating the partnership would be a great idea, not only for the state, but to help reduce the congestion in the Salem area.
So really quick, I'm not sure which one to ask. Do you recall what the investment was that was being made prior to it being eliminated? What the dollar amount was?
Mr. Chair, I don't have that number with me, but I know we have it, and I can get it to you.
Thank you. Sorry to interrupt.
Okay. So, and that concludes my testimony. So, if there's
any questions?
Yes, Chair.
Yeah, Representative Kalman.
Thank you. The question I have is, have you done any discussion or communication, and this isn't a DAS question, this is a Salem-Keizer School District question. Some districts, you know, some schools, and whether it's Grants Pass or Medford, have free bus passes for students. Is that something you've done or in the past or would consider in the future?
Sure. Co-Chair Smith, Representative Comp. Several years ago, we did offer a student bus pass program for all Salem-Keizer middle and high school students. It was funded through the Business Energy Tax Credit Program, and we provided for 2.5 school years unlimited rides for students. And we are certainly supportive if we can find a funding source to help do that.
Because I know in Wilsonville, Mr. Chair,
continue.
In Wilsonville, I used to tease my granddaughters because the city bus went by their house, and so did the school bus. And I says, well, which one do you ride? And they go, all depends when we get up. You know, teenage girls, what are you going to say? But, and so I know some communities have been very collaborative on that, but which is always wonderful. Yeah.
Co-Chair Smith and Representative Comp. During the time of the bus pass program, we provided thousands of rides a year to students, not only to and from school, but more importantly for the families, to after-school activities that allowed students to stay after school and maybe attend an event or go to an after-school job where maybe the parents both worked and they couldn't provide after-school transportation. We were kind of that opportunity for them. So it was highly successful. And
great, thank you.
So really quick, what's the service area that your transportation company provides?
Sure. Co-Chair Smith, the Chariot service is the service within the urban growth boundary of the Salem-Keizer area. We also operate called the Chemeketa Area Regional Transportation System, or CARTS, which provides service to the rural towns of Marion and Polk County.
Help reduce congestion, that's for sure.
Yes.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Well, Mr. Chair, it's not a question. The other comment for CARTS in communities such as mine in Woodburn and Jervis, they really provide an incredible service for a lot of elderly to get to their doctor's appointments.
Oh. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. At this point, again, with the chair's indulgence, we have a couple of other guests here to talk about a piece of the DAS budget, and that is the move of the Office of Administrative Hearings from the Employment Department to DAS. So
great.
If we may, we'll step aside for a minute.
All right. Come on up, Director. Welcome.
Co-Chair Smith and members of the committee, my name is Lisa Neisenfeld. I'm the director of the Oregon Employment Department. I'm here today briefly to talk with you about the proposed move of the Office of Administrative Hearings to DAS from the Employment Department. As you may know, OAH has been a part of the Employment Department for many years as an administrative convenience. There was a time when, when the majority of the OAH cases were unemployment insurance appeals. Right now, that number is about 66%. We're proposing this move not out of any economic interest or wanting to get rid of colleagues, but rather for the public perception of fairness. Many, many cases which come to the OAH in appealing their unemployment insurance decisions, people feel like their perception is that there's a conflict of interest, that the Employment Department is taking on its own appeals. And technically, that's correct. We do have an arm's length relationship. But it appeared to us that for better government, as it appears to the public, it would be easier to shift the Office of Administrative Hearings to DAS, particularly now that an increasing number of its cases are becoming outside unemployment insurance. And so I'm going to ask Gary to talk a little bit more specifically.
So really quick, though, looking at the notes, there's not going to be a physical move of employees. The
correct.
Budget's going to remain stable the same. Mm. It's just purely who has a response.
Co-Chair Smith, members of the committee, I'm Gary Tyler. I'm the Chief Administrative Law Judge with the Office of Administrative Hearings. That is correct. There would be no physical move. And also, with respect to the budget, the Office of Administrative Hearings bills the agencies for its service. So we have an appropriation, but we don't have a separate budget, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So this would be primarily a shift of the administrative support and not a move of the OEH. All of the positions that we currently have stay right where they are in the physical positions, physical locations where they are. The buildings that we occupy, we would continue to sit in those buildings. We would just be shifting about six areas of support, budgeting, the accounting piece, HR, and the IT support from the Employment Department over to DAS to do that function for the Office of Administrative Hearings.
Any questions? Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions. One is, did you contemplate other agencies that might have been a home for this activity? I'm not saying DAS is not a good choice. I'm just wondering, did you think about what are the options here for the appropriate location? And the other question is, with this change, I'm assuming that it means DAS can handle the extra load and that the department you're leaving can handle the loss. But if DAS can handle doing some extra work, what happens with the freed up time over the at the employment department?
Well, Co-Chair Smith, Representative Nathanson, yes, to your first question, we did contemplate other agencies. If I could have the second slide, it might be helpful. You can see that we do about 19,000 hearings a year for the employment department. DAS is in the other programs section down there, the 671 hearings. Out of that 671, we only did 9 hearings for DAS. So we were looking for an agency because of the perception of independence. We were looking for an agency that we do not do many hearings for, and DAS fell into that category. We were also looking for an agency that's set up to administer our needs that we have in the areas that I mentioned, and DAS does that. So that was the way we selected DAS as the best candidate. We did look at several other agencies, though, as well, and ruled those out for a number of reasons. And
so can we return back to the previous slide?
Yes.
And I guess I just want to reiterate so I'm clear on this. The reason we're doing this is for bullet point number one. And that's cool, but I just want to make sure that's
correct.
That is the reason we're doing this.
That is the reason.
And if I may answer Co-Chair Smith and Representative Nathanson, the question about administrative support, we'll be transferring 3 FTE from OED to DAS that handle that administrative function for OAH.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
I really appreciate your slide. Very straightforward, very matter of fact. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, the House side of the committee is very efficient today. We are actually near the end of our planned presentation, so we'll just carry
forward.
Mr. Jordan,
what else are you taking over? We're changing your name to, like, Czar.
Oh, Mr. Chairman.
We already have one in education.
Just very, very briefly, we have a number of packages related to some of the things we've talked about today. These are not all of the packages for enterprise asset management. Tomorrow, we're going to talk about capital projects in specific, and there are some specific to that we'll mention. But the purchase of additional vehicles, the parking, free bus pass program we just talked about. PERS has taken on their own building and would like to take on where their custodial services that we used to provide for them. And so they're keeping their custodian. We're just transferring the position from DAS to PERS. Governor's Office, Regional Solution Centers were created in statute 2 years ago. DAS leasing agents got those facilities up and running, and we've been paying the expenses and billing the agencies who are placed in those centers for the actual expenses on a monthly basis. What that does is eats up limitation in DAS real estate services. And so this package is for limitation only, so we can continue that build back program to those centers. There's some money for the state fairgrounds, and then of course the transfer of the Office of Administrative Hearings. There will be another package that we are developing to go along with that move that's related to OEH's case management system that we didn't get all the pieces in to the governor's budget. So we are working with them to develop that. And just to the question about whether or not DAS would be able to support that, we've been over the last year working with staff from the two agencies to put together sort of collaborative teams to figure out exactly what this lift and drop will look like to make sure that we've identified all the pieces. While it sounds to someone like me very easy, you just move the budget from one place to another and no one's moving, that seems like that should be a simple breeze. It's actually more complicated than that. We've got teams working on it so that if you decide that's an appropriate move, we'll be ready to do it.
So tomorrow, as Barry mentioned, we have a number of capital projects. We'll go over them with you. I think I've mentioned earlier that about 2.5 years ago, we reorganized the agency to implement the entrepreneurial management that came out of House Bill 5002 about 6 years ago, actually. And we're making some adjustments to that. We are 2 years in, and we realized we weren't infinitely wise about every component part of that reorganization, and now we've found a couple things that we need to tweak. So we'll talk to you about those. The management project, some of you may be aware, has been going on for about 2 years now. I want to update the committee. This has to do with the state's relationship with its managers, quite frankly, and it's a project that goes across really all the human resource relationships, whether it's recruitment, workforce development, performance accountability, and classification and compensation. So we'll talk bring you up to date on where we are with that project. And then lastly, a couple of things I want to mention that we're doing enterprise-wide, and we've changed, I think I mentioned this earlier, changed a contractual arrangement with Mass Ingenuity regarding a management framework that many agencies are using, and we would like to make it basically the state standard. So we've changed that contractual relationship. And then a bit of an esoteric topic, but I really wanted to bring it to the committee's attention. We're right on the cusp of moving into a project that we call business architecture or enterprise architecture. It's a pretty important move for us, and I want to fill the committee in on that and obviously try to take any of your questions. So that's what we'll do tomorrow.
Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since we have a few minutes, I want to ask you about state-owned buildings. You had a map and showed where we own buildings around the state. There's something that I've really forgotten the details and the rationale. State-owned, does it mean owned by, well, it's owned by the state, but is it assigned, is the ownership assigned to DAS or to an individual agency? And I have come to understand that I believe some agencies can own their building or be assigned ownership, but not Oregon State Police. So can you help me understand what the situation is?
So, Mr. Chairman, Representative Nathanson, I'll start, and I'm sure Barry will correct me and fill in the blanks. There are, I believe, 17 agencies that are allowed to own property in statute, and the Oregon State Police currently is not one of them. So I believe there may be a bill in this session that would allow the state police to own property. Many of those agencies make sense. So the Department of Transportation, obviously, rights of way and tons of property that they own by necessity. Oregon State Parks, we own a lot of parks, and it makes sense for them to do that. So Fish and Wildlife, who own fish hatcheries and a number of other specialized kinds of properties. So each of those have their own unique reasons for being able to own and manage their own properties. But generally speaking, I can tell you from my perspective, I'm not a big fan of expanding that list. We think we managed the properties and, in fact, just managed a consolidation of facilities for state police that I think we just talked about yesterday or the day before. I guess the answer to your question is there are a number of agencies that can own property in statute.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and Representative Nathanson, I might just note, too, that if you saw the slide earlier about the condition of the state properties, DAS properties, that's in due large part because they include a part of their uniform rent is some money to make sure that those buildings are maintained. Mm-hmm. When state agencies own the buildings, they're responsible for budgeting money that they have that could be used for other things to maintain those buildings. And our office has found that usually they don't do the greatest job in prioritizing deferred maintenance above other programmatic needs in the agency. So I think our office is also, is a little bit cautious about the number of state agencies that can own facilities.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nathanson, if I may add as well, I think the key, regardless of how many agencies can own or do own state property, is the coordination on a statewide basis of what our strategy is for our footprint. If you remember this slide, we lease about twice as much space as we actually own. And despite the best efforts of our leasing agents, leasing is not always the best, most cost-effective option. And so being able to coordinate a strategy where we are able to consolidate footprints together, get more people into a building we own is a better deal for the state. So regardless of whether the state police owns property or not, that coordination role which DAS plays is really important.
Thank you.
Any other questions on this subject? Can you visit with your folks in the motor pool and see if historically there's ever been any type of busing or commuting options groups of state employees on the interstates? The more I think about it, and going back with Representative Comp's question, I spend a ton of time on I-84. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times you see employees who are going to important meetings, I'm sure, but you watch one state vehicle and then you see another. I wonder if the state's ever looked at the efficiency that could be had by having a commuter bus that did the drive and did the drive back and did the drive down and did the drive back and gave the employees that opportunity to travel via a commuter. I'm just curious if it's ever been done. I'm not
Mr.
advocating
Chair,
it.
I'm we will look into it and get back
Certainly.
To you.
Certainly. We'll look into it.
Mr. Chair, the other thing that has come up, and I've had the honor to serve on the Veterans Committee a couple sessions, is if you're in Primeville, it's not always easy to get to a veterans hospital, and that kind of transportation could be, we could be a lot more innovative in some of those ways.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Comp, I couldn't agree more, and in fact, there is a project and a discussion going on with multiple agencies, including the Department of Transportation, about the myriad of funding sources that come from multiple programs, federal and state, to provide transportation for different populations, and really trying to coordinate that money so we do a better job hitting all the different needs in an area, for instance. So I know that discussion's going on right now.
Good.
Yeah.
And I guess playing through on my thought is to me, it would seem like if I was a state employee and I had a meeting in LeGrand, mm-hmm. and I had an opportunity to hop on a commuter van and let someone else do the driving and go there, spend the night, and then catch the van when it comes back through.
Okay.
I just wonder if that's ever been done.
We'll look into it, Representative, Mr. Chairman. I think it's a great idea.
Any other questions? See how efficient the house is?
It's just amazing.
We're done 35 minutes early. All right. We really appreciate you folks being here today, and we look forward to our agenda tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Paul, is there anything else we need to think about?
Nope.
All right. Julie, anything? We're good. So we're going to adjourn for the day.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. So we're going to adjourn for the day.
Thank you.
Thank you.